Welcome, everyone, to another episode of the Commerce Marketer Podcast. I'm your host, Greg Zakowitz, and I'm excited to be joined today by John Andrews, co-founder and CEO of Prevailing Path and shopper marketer extraordinaire. John has held positions such as being the founder of Collective Bias, which was acquired by Idmar in 2016, and with brands such as Walmart, Rubbermaid, and Kodak, just to name a few. Today, we're going to talk about lots of topics, including the state of retail and the customer's path to purchase. So let me welcome to the show, John Andrews. Welcome, John.
Thank you, Greg. I'm glad to be here.
So, John, like me, you live and work in the Raleigh-Durham area. So many of my guests come in from, and whether we're on location or just dialing in, New York, LA, Chicago, kind of those bigger cities. Tell the audience why Raleigh-Durham is better than those places.
Man, what an easy question. You know, this is my family's second time living here. We moved here we moved to the RTP area in 2003 and went to work for a consumer packaged goods company here called M Plus that is still here and doing great. In 2007, we left. I went to work for Walmart and we moved to Arkansas. And we really enjoyed our time in Arkansas and knew we would be there, you know, 5 to 7 years. And sure enough, at the end of about 7 years, we had started a company and transitioned out of that. And we were kind of looking for a place to live. And I had thrown out a couple places, you know, kind of a flyer. Hey, you know, let's move to Austin. My wife was like, hey, you know, our family lives on the East Coast, you know. And she said, let's go back to Raleigh. And I said, you know what? That's a great idea. Raleigh is what we call a Goldilocks city. It's not too big. You know, we met in Atlanta. And Atlanta, as you know, if you've been there, or Charlotte lately, it's just massive and growing all the time, as are we, but in I think a different way, a little spread out. And it's not too small. You know, there's kind of everything you want here. There's a world-class airport, you know, 2 hours from the ocean, 3 hours from the mountains. It's our home, and it's a place that we really love.
Excellent. I'm going to follow up on the Walmart point that you mentioned just a second ago, but I mentioned that you're the co-founder and CEO of Prevailing Path. Before we kind of get into the meat and potatoes today, why don't you give the listeners a little bit of background about who Prevailing Path is, what you guys do, and any sort of information kind of sets the stage for today.
Of course. Prevailing Path is a company we founded late last year, this is our first year in business. And the idea is really, if you think about my past 20 years in consumer packaged goods and in retail, my business partner, Ted Rubin, who, you know, began his kind of digital path with working for Seth Godin and going through, we met when he was the CMO of Elf Cosmetics. Prevailing Path really brings together some of the things that we've been working on collectively the past decade in thinking about how consumers, how shoppers, you know, how they go along their purchase journey on digital channels. So, you know, it's a very different shopping experience, I think, from physical retail, which is still obviously the dominant form of retail. But as we move into a place where goods and services kind of come to us, for lack of a, you know, more sophisticated definition, it's a very different experience that we're having. And what we found as we talked to lots of brands and retailers about this is they didn't really have a great handle on what happens as consumers progress along that journey. So Prevailing Path really was our attempt to begin to define that empirically. We built a path score, which is designed to evaluate, you may be familiar with clout. It's designed to give some directional information on where people are connecting along the path to purchase, how well-developed a brand is at those connection points, and how do they compare to their competitive set as consumers are progressing along that journey. Once we've defined that, and a path score is something that we do as we're talking to any new or potential client, we then have the ability to create content along that path to purchase, to manage that content in ways where it becomes the most effective and the most efficient, and then help people increase their connectivity with shoppers as they go along the path. So lots to figure out. You know, we've done to date about 50 path scores from people ranging from Amazon Fresh to the folks at Belkin to different folks that we've known from our past lives, as well as some new kind of folks in the small to medium business space, which we identified as there's some gaps there as well. And we're having some pretty good success. We're having a decent first year. We've got a team of about 8 people now that are trying to figure this out, and we continue to grow and learn and put this into play.
So you're telling me it's not just as easy as putting a photo on Instagram and calling it a day, right?
If only that were the case. No, you know, I think that's a really good point. People are putting photos on Instagram every day, and those become part of the overall experience that a consumer may have as they're seeking information. You know, what we see and what we think that there is probably an oversupply of is there's still a lot of old school messaging. You know, I was talking to some entrepreneurs yesterday that are in a similar space, and they said, yeah, it's like 1950s, you know, predominant market is I'm still pushing messaging at people hard. If you think about the way people are communicating along the path to purchase today, it's still primarily push, you know, and it's really good push now, right? Because we've got all this data about people. So you know the experience. If you search anything at all, whatever you search is going to follow you around any place you go, you know, digitally for the next 3 weeks, right? So all of a sudden, you know, I've got a pair of hiking boots literally tracking me around the web as I, you know, I'm on Facebook or I'm on my mobile phone or I'm on a website or whatever. These hiking boots are showing up. And I'm like, you know, that's great, but I was just trying to get a little more information on hiking boots. I really don't need an overwhelming, you know, push supply. And I think that trying to figure out now is as we move into a place where I can get pretty much any information about any product or service anytime that I want, what am I finding in the primary places where I'm looking in different categories? So, you know, my wife and I love to cook together, and we spend, you know, a lot of our cooking time and our recipe inspiration time on Pinterest, I think like a lot of people do. And we had an experience kind of this past week where we were, you know, it was cold and rainy here in the Triangle, and we were going to make some chili. And I said, oh man, let's make some chili. So she's on allrecipes.com, which, you know, I think it's the leading recipe site probably. You know, she's getting hammered by all of these ads that are trying to fill in this inventory and actually making the site unreadable. And finally, I said, you know, why don't you just go to Pinterest, where you can just read a piece of content and kind of have a better user experience? And she agreed. We ended up there making something that I think maybe a blogger or somebody had made. And so I think it's just, you know, we're at a place where the consumer's journey is changing. And there's a lot of opportunity to think about and explore what that journey is and think about how do I connect with that consumer in a way that's just not overwhelming noise to them along that path, that digital path to purchase. Sorry, that's probably a longer answer than you wanted.
No, it's actually good because it saves me from talking, and everyone who listens knows I'm very long-winded. So I'm going to combine two questions because I want to follow up on what you said. I don't want to dismiss one, but I also want to follow up on the 11 Moms program. And I think these questions kind of will combine here to make one point. So
sure.
You used to work for Walmart, and you were the creator of the 11 Moms influencer marketing platform. So I want to combine a little description from your side about what that was, what was the genesis of saying, hey, this is actually a pretty good idea, or we should follow through with checking this out and seeing if there's some fruit here. Because you were obviously noticing some consumer behavior changes back then. You had mobile phones starting to become a little more popular at the time. But changes you saw back then, which led you to develop that program, the influence of it, and how those changes back then have translated into progressive changes for consumers today as well. So is there a drastic difference between behavior changes today versus consumers of 7 to 10 years ago, and whether that model still holds true for today, the 11 Moms model, that is?
Yeah, no, that's a wonderful question. So 11 Moms really came out of, I had joined Walmart on the grocery marketing team and spent a lot of my time thinking about big kind of tentpole events in grocery, you know. So if you think about game time and holiday baking and things like that, you know, we did a lot of cooperative advertising with our supplier partners And, you know, you would walk in a store and there'd be a big display about game time. We'd have TV advertising and digital and radio and print and whatever. And it was kind of a typical retail thing, just at scale of a Walmart. I was asked to help form a emerging media team in late 2007, early 2008. And I said, yeah, man, that sounds really wonderful. What is emerging media? And it was, you know, it was defined for me as everything beyond the banner ad. I said, okay, so, social was just coming out of the ground. I don't think at the time you could actually join Facebook. I think you still had to be in college to be able to join Facebook. Twitter was new, you know. Location-based stuff was coming out of the ground, you know, all of the stuff. And I said, gosh, this sounds really great. How in the world do you figure this out? And I began to just simply look at what happened when I Googled things like saving money on groceries and saving money. And increasingly when I did that, I found that the content that came up was not from Walmart, you know, saving money on groceries. That's kind of Walmart's core brand promise, right? You know, or saving money on whatever. But the content that came up came from bloggers, and it was really good content, you know, and there were all kinds of genres of people who were creating content about the frugal lifestyle and simple living and couponing and all kinds of different ways. And I began to connect with some of these people to understand, hey, what are you doing and how are you doing this and why are you doing it? We formed a little private group where we could begin to have discussions, and I was just more curious than anything. And then one day we had a really cool opportunity. Apple had decided that they were going to start selling the iPhone at Walmart. You know, the first 18 months, I think, of its life, it was not sold at Walmart. And Walmart astutely pointed out that it sold more iPods at the time than Apple did. So maybe their customers were kind of ready for it. So we were launching the phone. And, you know, we were having a meeting and talking about, well, you know, what's the purchase experience is going to be like? You know, it's probably going to be challenging, you know, in a place that sells steaks to have good customer service on, you know, something maybe as complicated as the iPhone. And I said, well, you know, let's take our mom group at the time, our blogger group, let's give them gift cards and let's send them along the path to purchase and let's understand that. And I had an idea in the back of my head that I thought that they would probably publish content about. Actually, I knew that they would, but I really didn't probably mention that to people I work with because I think people would have freaked out about it. So they did. And what was really interesting is that content was really, really good. And it was really relevant to their audience. If you think about it, I'm a frugality blogger. How do I justify a $600 phone purchase? And the stories that came out was, well, because I can get Gas Buddy and I can find the lowest price of gas and I can use coupon apps and all kinds of reasons that made the iPhone relevant to that shopper. So I love the storytelling aspect of that. What I didn't expect was how well it would organically connect the dots between Walmart selling the iPhone and what happens on Google search. And it did that organically. And I'm like, oh, whoa, this is really cool. This is a thing. So we began to build cooperative influencer marketing programs at that time using the 11 Moms Group and had companies like Procter & Gamble and Coca-Cola and Disney that became supporters of those programs, just like we would have done any other cooperative programs.
You were seeing this change really in consumers back then, right? They looked at this and like, oh, I could save, I don't know, they save 40 cents on a gallon of gas or for a tank of gas or whatever. But they saw the applicable tools beyond the device, right? They saw what could happen there. Obviously, we live in a day and age now where that has really come to fruition. You could pretty much do anything on your phone.
Sure.
Have consumers really changed since then, other than ease of actually purchasing? Do you think back then they were still going, oh, well, you know, this is a tool where retailers should probably cater to me? Do you think they've always wanted retailers to cater to them, or is it just kind of hyper accelerated now what they expect retailers to deliver to them?
Man, that's a great question. And I like how you position that. I think the expectation of a retailer has changed. And I really think that's the crux of kind of what we're talking about is a retailer used to be a place that edited products for me. So you know, a smaller retailer might have a smaller assortment and maybe they have premium items or they have something, you know, a retailer like Walmart has a big edit, you know, it's got 40 feet of toothpaste, maybe 1,000 SKUs of toothpaste for me to choose from, you know, whatever. But retailers were a place that I went to get something. And retailers were really in control of that thing because you know, one of the primary factors of why we shop retail, and still why we shop retail, is it's closest to my house. You know, I have a Harris Teeter that's walking distance of my house. Guess where my groceries come from? Even though I probably prefer Whole Foods, it's a whole 3 miles away. I mean, I'm not going there. Now, I think expectation is changing that how much of our holiday shopping this year will be done online, on our phones, whatever. I read a good article this week that said this is the crossover point where more holiday shopping gets done via phone than it does actually from a desktop, a laptop. That's a different experience. And I have different expectations all the way from I'm not going to pay for shipping. It's not optional. I'm not paying for shipping. To I expect that anything that I get, I want to receive, interact with, return, whatever, in the most friction-free way possible. I'm not sure that that is a conscious thing that consumers are thinking about every day. It's just the, whoa, wait, I used to go to a store 8, 9, 10 times a week for things that I needed versus, yeah, maybe now I just go for fresh groceries and everything else I'm getting online. You know, that's an extreme example. But I think the ease of use of me curating goods and services in ways that were never possible, you know, because of all the technologies that are now coming together to kind of solve the last mile problems, change how we interact and our expectations. And then take that a step further now, when you think about how technology is even making that process easier. So we have an espresso machine, you know, a coffee brewing machine that we have auto replenishment for our coffee, you know, so our coffee shows up once a month. There is actually an espresso that will track my coffee usage and the individual coffees that I'm choosing and use that information to then automate my ordering versus just a kind of a dumb replenishment order, if you will. Man, think about the extrapolation of that across retail over the next 10 years. Our fundamental relationship with a retailer and with brands, quite frankly, is going to change.
If I could boil that down, definitely saying convenience trumps price in your mind, correct?
And I would actually go further with that to say simplicity, because convenience, I think, is just one factor. So the whole idea is, you know, the reason I love to order stuff from Amazon, you and I could be, you know, having a coffee or having a beer or something, and we're talking about some great book you read. It would take me about 15 seconds to take my phone out and have that book at my house the next day via my Amazon mobile app, right? And I could probably do it, you know, in voice. Even more so, think about voice ordering. Think about Alexa now. So we run out of, I tell the story all the time. We run out of peanut butter. My wife is frugal and we don't hold peanut butter. You know, I don't know why, because peanut butter has a half-life of 100 years or something. It's not going to go bad, but we run out of peanut butter. So now as we run down on peanut butter, I just order it from Alexa standing in my kitchen when I realize I'm running out. I love a spoonful of peanut butter at night. That is going to fundamentally, I think, trump price, which I think was the primary driver or competitive set for retail for years. Price is pretty transparent. Unless I'm just really a bad shopper now, I can probably get the lowest price. How easy can you make it for me to receive, to interact with, and to return or whatever so you're taking the friction out of buying?
So you've said three things I want to spiderweb off to, and I got to figure out which one I'm going to start with first.
Okay.
Let's start with price first.
Sure.
I think you know it. I know it. I can get the lowest price wherever the hell I want to, right? I can go to Retail Me Now if I'm online. I can go to Amazon. I can do whatever. And Amazon's probably going to beat you in price on most things because they can. If it's a price-driven thing, and we all know consumers are changing, expectations and convenience is certainly a bigger factor for most shoppers now. Retailers are struggling to adopt to that for some reason. And they put themselves in this corner, but hey, let me just incentivize even more. I incentivize and it's keeping up with the Joneses. Now we're incentivizing for all of November and then it's all of October. And now it's year round where we just keep discounting, which actually works in Amazon's favor to start letting them beat each other out. But if retailers know that discounting is not the total solution and see other things, why are they so slow to make changes? Is it old school thinking internally in upper management there? Is it logistical challenges? Why do you think retailers are struggling so much to adopt to changing expectations?
You know, it's a good question. So speaking from, having worked at the world's largest retailer, there is a big established business that requires daily care and feeding and most people's attention. When I worked at Walmart, you know, the e-com business was frequently described as a rounding error. And people would put it in the context of our entire e-com business is equivalent to the revenue of 9 super centers. I think that's what it was when in 2007. You know, so think about that. 9 really powerful super centers generate, you know, a big super center would generate $200 to $300 million in revenue a year. It's hard to, I think, go and have focused attention on, okay, but 10 years from now, what's going to happen and how can we place bets to do that? You know, Walmart probably could be much further along today in e-commerce had it simply put in drive-thrus 10 years ago, which would have been pretty easy. I mean, logistically, there's some challenges. But essentially, what are they doing today? They're putting in drive-thrus for grocery pickup, right? You know, so you think about that. Just put in drive-thrus. It's not sexy. It doesn't. There's no VR, AI, whatever. But it makes it really simple for families to manage their time and energy. Of I order all my groceries and I drive through and pick them up. You know, I had coffee with a friend this morning at Starbucks, and I walked in to get my coffee, and he's like, "Why are you not ordering ahead using the app?" and looked at me like I was crazy. And I'm like, well, I guess, I don't know. I like talking to the barista, but I don't know. I actually didn't have a good answer, but it was mainly just because it hadn't occurred to me, you know, because it didn't take that long, but I guess it'd save a minute of my day. Well, who knows? It's an interesting dynamic. You know, I think part of the other problem becomes there's still a lot of thinking about the business linearly. Right? A retailer is still a shelf and a place. And if you talk to a lot of people and you say, well, hey, you know, what happens when retail becomes 50% or, you know, e-commerce or direct replenishment becomes 50% of all retail? And people are like, oh my God, that's forever. You know, it's only 10% now. And I'm like, yeah, but there will be an inflection point where e-commerce hockey sticks. And I kind of think we're there. I mean, if you look at other markets, if you look at China, it's already over 20%. India, you know, places, it could happen so fast and destroy kind of the traditional margin models, which aren't huge anyway. You know, I mean, you pointed out Amazon can go to war all day with people on price. It could because it had this sort of, you know, could do no wrong. We don't have to make any money before. But now what people don't realize, you know, Amazon's going to do $8 to $10 billion of media this year. You know, Amazon's become the number one place where product searches begin. So that $8 to $10 billion is high margin. You know, that's 70 margin revenue probably for those guys. AWS, you know, services have become a big part of their business. They can fund a margin war that if you've got this heavy brick and mortar deployment, you probably can't fund in the same way. You know, Walmart's not going to generate $10 billion worth of media this year. That's a huge competitive advantage that probably was not on the radar of anybody at Walmart in a significant way or other retailers until they see, you know, now these new models. You know, Alibaba, I think, is going to generate $16 billion in media revenue this year. As a retailer becomes a place where I also get information and it becomes part of the shopper process, Amazon is going to become a very, very powerful player against Facebook and Google. I don't know why as a brand I would actually spend a lot of money on Facebook versus Amazon, to be honest with you, because there's more attention there when I'm further down the funnel of the shopping process.
With that, do you think these traditional legacy retailers, you know, JCPenney's and the like, do you think because of this, you know, again, Amazon can absorb those losses on the product margin side because of the other things like AWS. Do you think they're just going to wait out these stores kind of dying off and the consumers coming over? Do you think there's any hope for some of those legacy retailers? Or do you think if they make a pivot, they can continue to survive in today's climate?
It's a good question. You know, I think if you look at last week, you know, what happened to a company like Mattel, they got pretty beat up in the marketplace last week, you know, when they came out and announced somewhat disappointing earnings. And then top of, they're going to take a $125 million hit, I think it is, from inventory that they have at Toys R Us as a bankrupt. There's going to be a cause and effect between brands and retailers as they go on. And if you think about a lot of categories, we have an awful lot of capacity. I think in the United States, we have 350 square feet of retail per person in the United States. I think we're 10x the next most developed country, which is the UK. Man, that's an awful lot of capacity that at the end of the day is pretty low margin stuff. Any change in volume is going to be pretty significant, I think, for these guys. So I think that my prevailing opinion is, if there is not some reason for your retailer to be relevant to me, I just can't see how, you know, 40 to 50% of our current retail deployment survives, just because there's a lot of duplication of effort and product that, you know, I'm going to just either get directly from a brand or from, you know, my main shopping resource, which online is Amazon.
Walmart is one of those companies that obviously has a lot of business. They're going back and forth with Amazon, going tit for tat. I find it really interesting to kind of see what's happening with them and, you know, acquisitions and kind of pivoting strategies back and forth. Mm-hmm. Do you see Walmart's strategy of the last year, you know, acquisitions, trying to move up market a little bit with some of those acquisitions, expanding their online presence with the Jet acquisition, things like that, and getting some of their great value products onto the Jet marketplace? Do you think, one, it's having a positive effect, and do you think that's the right strategy now for Walmart to take, or do you think they should kind of focus somewhere else? It's almost like they're trying to become Amazon of 10 years ago, replicate that strategy, and just kind of pick up things as they go along. How do you see that thing shaking out?
Man, that's the $64,000 question, right? I'll be honest with you, I don't know. I don't think, and again, this, I have some perspective from being there. I think one of Walmart's challenges was it has its .com unit out in California. It has its stores unit in Arkansas. I think that's a challenge because I think that doesn't promote the fundamental need that most retailers have today, which is one view of the customer. I, as a Walmart shopper, am going to increase some percentage of my purchases online. How are you making that just seamless for me? And, you know, and there's story after story after story of, you know, I buy something on Walmart.com, but I can't necessarily return it at the store for the same price because it doesn't have the same price. Walmart has price matching. One of the entities that does not match the price is Walmart.com, which is absolutely baffling to me, you know, because as a shopper, I'm like, wait, both of these have the Walmart logo. Your logistics problems are not my problem as a customer. My expectation is every piece of the Walmart relationship should be interoperable. And I think they're working on that. I think the strategy of adding non-related brands, and especially non-related brands that are irrelevant to the Walmart customer, like a Walmart customer is not probably going to buy, you know, $100 Bonobos khakis, I don't think personally makes a lot of sense. And I think the structural challenges of integrating those teams and systems and everything is probably a distraction versus, hey, why don't we move our whole digital unit to Arkansas and all sit together and be one team, one dream? Seems like a much more simple strategy to me.
I, for one, have this idea that it makes sense for Amazon to get into some of that quote-unquote supercenter models with their stores. Mm-hmm. I look at this Kohl's partnership as kind of, oh, let's use Kohl's as a beta, right? Are we going to see, does it actually increase the rate of return?
Yeah.
Does it decrease the rate of return, you know, and kind of see whether it makes sense there? Kohl's, I don't know why the hell they did it. My envision is, well, they'll return some clothing, and while they're there, they'll look at clothing over here and buy that replacement item there. So they'll try to acquire customers that way. But I think it's going to wind up hurting Kohl's in the long run. But I see the superstore model as something Amazon could put their hands around. They've got plenty of white labeled products, which they could sell there. They obviously have more and more clothing lines coming out. They've got subscription clothing services. They have Whole Foods, which presents logistical issues just from size, right? I think Amazon will get into the pharmacy business, which you can't really jam a pharmacy in the Whole Foods now, at least most stores, because of the footprint. And I do think pickup in store for Amazon will become a bigger thing, right? They want to put lockers in there. So for me, I look at that and I'd say, it makes sense for Amazon to get the store model because you could get even more people coming in their prime and really take some of that that business away from Walmart there. Just in your personal opinion, where do you see that going?
Man, that's a good question too. So I don't know if you saw the article this week. There's a Whole Foods that relatively new, it's a couple years old, that was built in Fayetteville, Arkansas, which is where I used to live. Wish they would have been there when I was there. But it's a fantastic store. They just put Amazon lockers in that store. So now you've got an Amazon footprint in Walmart's back door. It's going to be interesting to see how that. I can imagine if Sam were still alive, he'd be there shopping that store every day and trying to figure it out. I mean that's what Sam did. He was a student of retail, really a neat kind of guy. I think that the Whole Foods thing, really made sense because it gave Amazon that physical presence that they really didn't have, and probably with a related customer. And what's the first thing they did is they started lowering prices. And I think the last I saw is the total basket price at Amazon went down. I mean, at Whole Foods went down about 5%. Right. The partnership with Kohl's, I'm with you, it baffles me. If you look at Toys R Us, Toys R Us outsourced its e-com to Amazon, and I think it's now bankrupt. You basically gave up the relationship with your customer. It just doesn't make a lot of sense. And so either my business partner, Ted Rubin, and I have had this conversation several times because we're scratching our head about the Kohl's thing too. It's like, so maybe they're setting themselves up as an acquisition target. Who knows? But, I think if you look at the middle, it's typically a bad place to be in retail. If you think Kohl's and Penny's and Target will probably be all right because it's able to, I think, create a niche. But, I mean, Target's total retail is not that big when you think about their footprint. I would never relinquish my relationship with my customer to anyone else. And so I think it's going to be challenging for a lot of folks to think about it because I believe if you go back to the idea of simplicity, it's just easy for me to get stuff from Amazon. And if Amazon becomes a pharmacy, that would be the same thing, right? I mean, a lot of pharmacy is already becoming mail order and through their thing anyway. So if I'm already shopping at one place, what's one more category? Travel and tickets and other things, I think, go the same way.
Absolutely. You mentioned browserless commerce before, voice assistants, so like Alexa with ordering, and you do some of that.
Yeah.
I want to circle back, 20 minutes later on that as well, because that's the one thing where it's obviously becoming a bigger thing. There's a lot of opportunity in just kind of these browserless type devices. I look at it from a brand perspective and I say, hey, this has the potential to lose signature brand value for companies like, Kleenex, for example, or Bounty. You gave the peanut butter example before. Hey, Alexa, order me some more peanut butter. I think for people growing up in this age group, so we talk about Gen Z or even younger, I think they're calling what, the alpha generation now, like my son. I get to this point where if I'm just going, hey, Alexa, order me peanut butter, I lose whether it's Jiffy or it's 365 value or Peter Pan or whatever. I'm just getting peanut butter, and that could be Amazon's white label peanut butter, or which could be 365. But I start thinking about it as a commodity. It's peanut butter, not as a brand of peanut butter.
Yeah.
I don't really know the question I'm trying to ask you here, but do you see any potential danger for brands to really start losing the value they've worked so hard over the last, 50 to 100 years of cultivating because it's just a different way of shopping for some people and it's growing? They might have to double down on, hey, we need to really reinforce that we are Kleenex, not tissues.
Yeah, I think it's a great question. I think it's a real danger for a lot of brands. Already, the number one basket item in the States is bananas, right? It's in more baskets than anything else. Number two is batteries. Amazon has a 90% share of online batteries. Of that 90%, 60% of it is Amazon Basics brand, is Amazon brand. And exactly the process that you just described is exactly what's happening. So if I order batteries, and I've done this, and so if I order batteries from Amazon, you know, Alexa comes back to me and says, Alexa recommends Amazon Basics, 20 count for a 97, whatever, and would you like to order? And if I say no, the second thing that we suggest, or at least the latest time I did it, is Duracell. And then past that, Alexa says, hey, you know what, go to the app and figure it out yourself. But, you know, she said, you know what, dude, it's batteries, to your point. Do you really care, you know, as long as they last? So there's a big category that I think Amazon's already said, hey, we're going to go own these things. And I think if you're a CPG brand, that would scare me to death. Because you're right. Do I care about my peanut butter? Now I actually order peanut butter by brand from Alexa. I have a Kahl's marketing brand of peanut butter that I like that I order from there. I was actually experimenting with ordering fancy butter. You know, I was trying to order Lurpak butter, and Alexa didn't understand what I was talking about. So you know, that was kind of a bust. But those systems are going to get good. And I think the other side of that is these systems are going to get very predictive. So already we've got refrigerators that kind of know what products are in them. They're aware of the, you know, either through EPC levels or scanning. I have an Alexa wand product that hangs on the side of my refrigerator, and we can scan every UPC that goes into our refrigerator and pantry. You know, that is a Trojan horse into automated ordering. And as other systems, you know, other IoT systems become part of that, you're going to enable, I believe shoppers are going to enable systems to just make sure that my refrigerator and my pantry are stocked with the things that I'm using anyway, and make my life even simpler. Man, you're right. That's going to be a big question of whether brand matters or not. And if your brand's not relevant, yeah, you know, good peanut butter is good peanut butter.
I think it's interesting that you said after a couple of times, Alexa just says, hey, go to the app and pick out what you want, right? It's like that Seinfeld, why don't you just tell me the name of the movie you want to see, right?
Exactly.
It's kind of smart from that perspective, right? Because you talked about simplicity. Consumers just want simplicity. Well, going to the app after talking to something is not really simple at that point, right? But they're not, if you're going to go to the app and do something, you're taking that extra device out. You're probably not doing price shopping at 14 different stores at that point. You might just go path of least resistance. All right, Alexa, order me the Amazon batteries. You might just concede to Amazon for simplicity purposes. Mm-hmm. Before we wrap up here, John, I want to talk about just briefly channels, right? Because Prevailing Path, you guys are following the customer journey across email, mobile, social, you know, brick and mortar, all these things here. Break down some of these channels for me now. So email marketing is obviously, from a Bronto standpoint, it's one of our core businesses, but email is extremely effective for marketing departments from an ROI standpoint. Social is obviously emerging like it's never emerged before. It seems like every day it's getting better and better, but social is a huge platform for influencing purchase decisions now and engaging and having connections between the brand and consumer. Push notifications, right? And you mentioned earlier, it's not a one-way conversation between brand and consumer anymore. So what channels do you find to be more effective? What are consumers like? Do they like going to stores and showrooming? Do they like going to the store and touching and feeling and buying stuff? Where do you see the channels kind of interacting with one another? Which ones are kind of dying out, if any are?
Yeah, it's interesting. I think it depends on category. You know, I think as we were discussing earlier, there are probably some low involvement categories that are, I think, more vulnerable to, hey, do I really care about putting time or energy into this? Or do I just order batteries? You know, do I just order peanut butter? You know, sacrilege for a brand guy to talk like that, probably, but maybe people don't really care that much versus, you know, a higher involvement category. I watch with some fascination. My local mall is Crabtree Valley Mall. It's kind of a, you know, more upscale mall, and probably in the past, you know, even since we've moved back to Raleigh in 2014, it's probably converted to 50% maybe food and entertainment now. So it's a place that we go, and I always think about this as a model for what's happening. You know, we have a new Seasons 52 there. It's a nice restaurant. We've got some good food, and right across from there is a North Face store. Every time I go in the North Face store, there's more and more experience. You know, they have a huge tent set up, and they've got, you know, displays that are inviting me to play with the stuff. And you start to think about, you know, I buy a $800 heavy weather coat from North Face. You know, that's a different purchase experience than my peanut butter. Cars. Will we still have car dealerships 10 years from now? I don't know. You know, Tesla would suggest maybe not. So I think by category, it's really going to depend on how involved the consumer is and how relevant the brands and the products in the category are to the consumer. And then I also think what happens with automation and technology that just make it easier for me to acquire things. And you mentioned it, that my friends and family have, you know, which is automatically being filtered for me now by social platforms, by even by email platforms, excuse me, like yours, thinking about how do I make these tools that I've used for a long time more relevant to me as a user.
Very cool. So, John, I certainly appreciate your time and insights today. I'm going to get you out of here on a question before we kind of do our wrap up here and closing comments. But I completely stole this from guy Bill Connolly over at Olapik, UGC platform. So a free plug for you guys. He asked me this when I was a guest on his podcast, and it completely stumped me. I couldn't think of what the hell to say. What is one thing you would never buy online?
Ooh, good question.
He asked me for three of them.
Wow.
Trying to get you off easy.
You know, it's interesting because I'm trying to think of as you ask that question, I'm trying to think of a category that I don't buy online.
And nothing could be an answer as well.
No, you know, I'm sure there's so, but I, you know, I'm just trying to think, you know, I bought, I probably bought our past five or six automobiles online. We buy travel online. I just got a shipment of wine, online. You know, I'm trying to think.
I think for the fact that we both struggle answering the question, I think a good way to kind of wrap this up, if you can't think of something offhand, is consumers will really go online for anything. So if you're a retailer and you're not focused on the online behavior and the path to purchase, you're kind of going to be in a world of hurt. Good out?
No, I thank you for rescuing me because I was trying to think. You know, I had an experience a couple of years ago. My wife was we were building a deck, a back porch, and the contractor had asked her to order a whatever ceiling fan she wanted. Right, so she ordered a little too early, and of course contractors were a little slow. And it sat out on our porch for a couple months. And when it had installed, it had warped just a little bit. So there was just a little sound to it. And she'd ordered it from Amazon. And I never will forget this because she had some trust issues with, you know, how do I return stuff? And am I going to be able to do this? And when she went to return it, it was past the return date. I think there was a 60-day return window for this particular product. So she came back. She said, okay, well, you know, my fault, my bad, whatever. An hour later, she got an email from Amazon saying, hey, you know what? We're sending you a new one. Just take the old one, put it in the old box and send it back to us. We'll send you a label. And I watched her transform from, hey, I don't trust this, to this is the way I'm going to order everything. It was at that moment that I thought, "What exactly what you just said, there's not a category that's safe for not being disrupted by e-commerce."
That's a really strong testament to how important customer service is nowadays as well. I'm a huge customer service advocate. So I got great customer service from a company called NixPlay, which is, this happened just yesterday, but like a electronic screen, right? You can upload photos to it. So it's a photo, electronic photo thing.
Okay.
You can store 1,000 photos on there. So I've got it on my desk here at work. So my wife uploads pictures of the kids and stuff like that on there. And it's great.
That's cool.
It saves me some space. But the thing just like fried it, reset 2 days ago and completely fried the screen. And, you know, the thing's about 2 years old. And I emailed them and I said, you know, they tried to take me through a restart. I'm like, listen, it's not a restart. They're like, all right, we're going to escalate it. And 10 minutes later, I get an email. It's like, hey, we're shipping out a new one to the address we have on file, which is this, and we'll send you a return label and have a good day. And I'm like, hey, beautiful. Customer service, important. Your wife experienced it and now she's hooked, right?
And what just happened? You just became an advocate for the brand. And there's no amount of marketing, there's no amount of anything that brand could have done other than, it's to your point, great customer service experience that would have facilitated the conversation that you just had. Everyone has those conversations, and now we have them with, obviously, through our social channels, through much larger footprints. Customer service, the back end of what happens in e-commerce, is going to be critical. And you're right, if I'm missing that part, I'm probably not going to be very successful in those channels.
So, John, I think here's a good time to kind of wrap it up here. So we'll have your contact info in the description of the episodes on however you're listening, whether it's Google Play, Apple Podcasts, or on YouTube. But, John, if someone wants to get a hold of you, what's the best way to get a hold of you?
Easiest way is either by email, johnandrews@prevailingpath.com, or I am Katadin on every social channel, K-A-T-A-D-H-I-N. So that's Twitter, Facebook, LinkedIn, anything you can find me there.
Very cool. So John Andrews, co-founder and CEO of Prevailing Path. Thanks very much for your time today, John. And for everyone listening, until next time, have a great day, everyone, and be kind to one another.